From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we look at the impact of changes to the food share system in Wisconsin.
Later, a new book makes the case that it's important to recognize the influence of some of the lesser-known members of the Trump administration.
One thing to understand is, once these people are empowered, because Trump himself is not a detail man and does not have, by most measures, a long attention span, these people are moving on the basis of the power they've been given.
And the challenge of playing 35 different characters in a play that takes place in Nazi Germany.
I don't want them all to sound like Colonel Klink. I hope not everyone's going to go, oh, Hogan's Heroes. But as an actor, it's hard to just put on a voice in this play. Even if they appear for 30 seconds, they have to be fully realized.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In 2014, the number of people receiving food share benefits in Wisconsin dropped precipitously. And that sounds like a good thing. Fewer people needing financial help to buy food should mean that there are fewer people in need.
But it seems that might not be the case. As reporter Jabril Farage found out, the change in recipients could have more to do with changes to eligibility requirements.
Farage reported on the story for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and profiled a man named Derek Osborne, a disabled veteran and former food share recipient who became ineligible for the benefits in 2014. They both joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio, and Farage starts by explaining why he started researching the story.
Essentially, I started looking through food share numbers. You know, this was how this story kind of came about. I was just looking at the monthly enrollees for food share in Milwaukee County. And when you do that, you can see back to the beginning of 2010, those numbers were around 200,000 people every month. As of 2010, that started to increase. Essentially, it was described to me by a Department of Health Services spokesperson that food share benefits is what they call a lag economic indicator, which means that it shows up, you know, a year or so down the line and kind of responds to unemployment and how the economy is doing. So at the beginning of 2010, it started to increase to where it was just over 290,000 people per month in October 2013, stayed pretty right around there at 285,000. But right around the beginning of 2015, those numbers started to decline, so that by the end of 2015, just under 260,000 people a month were enrolled in food share in Milwaukee County. And by May of this year, that number was as low as 240,000. So when I talked to people, you know, they said, well, this is exactly what we warned about. A group of organizations, more than 25, wrote a letter in the spring of 2016 warning that changes that Governor Walker had made, so essentially declining to renew a waiver that had been put in place nationally because of the downturn in 2008 that allowed able-bodied adults without dependents to claim food share without the time limits that are usually associated with that. So typically, if you're an able-bodied adult without dependents, if you don't qualify for one of the many exemptions, you can only claim food share benefits for 3 months every 3 years. So at the end of 2014, Walker declined to renew this waiver, and this is where we find ourselves today.
There was a lot inside of that. You said it's a lag indicator that food share participation often kind of lags behind where the economy is at. What did employment numbers start to look like in 2014 or perhaps a little bit earlier?
It's kind of hard to nail down unemployment numbers for particular years. It's hard to find a place to, you know, where you can go and see that. But at this point, we know and it's been reported that unemployment is below 4% across the state. It's the lowest it's been in, I think, more than 15 or 16 years. However, Milwaukee County and some other counties around the state still have unemployment that is much higher I think the city of Milwaukee, Racine, and Beloit, I believe, all had unemployment rates that still hovered around 7%. So they qualified still for this waiver, along with a number of other counties, smaller counties across the state. But the waiver was discontinued across the state starting in 2014 and statewide in 2015.
Can you explain what the waivers do effectively?
Right. So these waivers, what they do is allow these able-bodied adults without dependents to claim food share benefits without the time limit, without being limited to 3 months every 3 years, even if they are not working 20 hours a week or claiming unemployment insurance or in school or in a substance abuse treatment program. You know, those are some of the exemptions that qualify people to receive benefits. But essentially the argument was after 2008 into 2010 and after was that the unemployment rates are so high in these areas where there aren't enough jobs for people, that people's unemployment insurance is running out, that you have a lot of regular people who don't qualify for these exemptions but still need help with their food.
Derek, you were part of the food share program. When you first started receiving those benefits, what was the application process like?
You could go online, fill it out, and they would call you up. You'd have your food stamps within a week.
And what did you need at that point to qualify?
Just don't have a job. I think I applied in 2010, and at the time I was in a substance abuse program, so I guess that would probably qualify for me getting the food share. But then, yeah, 2014, things changed really quick. I was living in Racine. I had just started getting benefits for PTSD, you know, service-connected disability, starting school. And when I reapplied for the food share program, they were like, you're going to have to take FSET, and that's the work study that goes along with the food share program. At the time, I'm like, well, I'll be moving to Milwaukee in a month. I was living in Racine. It was like, what's the point of me doing this down in Racine, you know? So they were like, well, you'll get 3 months, and then after that, they'll cut you off. Once I got to Milwaukee and I started school, that is when I should have probably reapplied for them. They probably would have gave them to me. I was going to school full time. But unfortunately now, I was going to University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. But now I'm back at MATC, and I'm doing part-time, so they gave me a waiver that I needed to get filled out and have a doctor sign. Unfortunately, I go through the VA, and those doctors don't like to sign anything. So they just cut them off. And, yeah, I haven't had food stamps since 2014.
So the thing we found with Derek is that he's kind of right on the edge of a lot of these exemptions, has been in substance abuse treatment, isn't now, though, was taking school full time, is about three quarters at this point. And there's one more I can't remember.
So I'm service connected, but I'm only at 30%, so I can still work. So
right.
And that's confusing. I remember reading that and I went, so you have PTSD, your doctors are saying this, but you have 30%? And that I don't get.
Yeah, that's how the VA rates their programs. It goes from 10 to 100. I think at 50%, once you get to 50%, you can't work anymore. I mean, they just don't want you working. So if you're like the first to the 50%, yeah, you can work.
So a panel of psychiatrists
mm-hmm.
essentially decided this, that Derek was 30% disabled. So technically is still able to work and under this program doesn't qualify for that exemption.
I think in a lot of ways your story kind of points out the different holes that people can fall through.
When I moved to Milwaukee, I was like, well, exceptions have to be made. And the way they have it set up, there's no exceptions for food share anymore. None whatsoever.
I mean, what has that practically meant for your life as someone who has been a student who's trying to look for new work because what you had trained for before, you can't do anymore.
Right.
So what is it meant for your life?
Well, let's see. I was getting about $210 from the state for food share. So, yeah, I mean, I missed that $210 definitely. But I've gotten over it. I mean, you know, I still eat. Luckily for me, I do have a culinary degree, so I can pretty much make anything I want. So that makes it a lot easier. But, yeah, that $200 is a miss, definitely.
Yeah. And the, you know, the advocates who are saying that this is, quote unquote, punitive, that it's unnecessary, that it's essentially a decision that the state doesn't have to make. Now, the Department of Health Services, they said that in essentially instead of pouring resources, I guess, into food share, they instead decided to make this $60 million investment in this FSEP program, Food Share Employment and Training Program, which is kind of the alternative to if you're not employed 20 hours a week. They say, well, go to this program and search for work. I'm not exactly sure what's involved in that. I wasn't able to speak with someone at one of the organizations that administers that program. But, you know, that's what they're saying is that we put $60 million into this. Their initial report said that just over 18,000 people in the state got work through this program at an average of $12.21 per hour. But we're not sure what kind of work that is, whether it's full-time, part-time, temporary. And this is essentially, too, what some of those other what some of the advocates are saying is that these are decisions that are dehumanizing to people, that make assumptions about how essentially that people are lazy and that they are more favorable to corporate interests in this state than to people who have trouble eating.
So, Derek, you actually have experience with the FSET program. What was that like?
You would go into, I don't know, what do they call it? There's places you can go to apply for food stamps, and what they have is a bunch of computers set up, and that's how you would get your 20 hours logged in, is you would sign on to a computer and search for work that way. You're not actually going out looking for a job. You're just sitting at a computer looking for work. That's how the FSET program works.
Are there people there who are helping you or helping you apply for jobs or even helping you figure out what kind of jobs make sense?
They do have people there. Or you can go home. You can do it on your home. If you have a computer at home, you can log on there and do it at home. I went to one, I think, the first appointment I had with them. And then after that, I was living in Racine. And within 2 weeks, I was moved up here. And I had no idea where I'd go here in Milwaukee to log on to a computer and go through the FSET part of looking for work.
I mean, were there people who were trying to help you, figure out where you should go? Where, you know, did you tell them that you were moving to Milwaukee?
It didn't matter to them. In fact, it seemed like the place that I was going to in Racine, they were actually kind of rude about, you know, they didn't really want to help you. You know, you had to figure this out on your own and you had to do the work. You know, you would sit with a counselor, she'd explain it to you, and then pretty much you were on your own after that.
Which then does make it seem punitive.
Well, and again, you know, we can't make generalizations about, you know, what every center is like. And there are different agencies that administer this program for the state. The one in Milwaukee is called ResCare. But, you know, it is called the Food Share Employment and Training Program. And based off of what Derek said, it doesn't sound like he was getting much training. So besides that, again, this question was raised about what kind of jobs this is getting people, whether they are family sustaining. That was the real question, and I don't think we have a clear answer to it yet.
A number of advocates sent a letter to Governor Walker asking him to reinstate this waiver program. Has he responded to that request?
As far as I know, no. I reached out to the governor's office through his director of communications and received no response to a couple of phone calls. So the governor has yet to respond to any of the requests that I've made. So, you know, I don't know if it's the media organization I'm with or I just have to start trying something different. But no, to my knowledge, there has been no response to any of these calls. I don't know.
It seems like, at least at this point, this isn't a concern for the governor. The fact that some Wisconsinites are going to bed hungry despite the fact that there is this program that's supposed to help them.
Well, and to be fair, you know, I want to point out that there is no way to say that this is directly caused by this decision. But like I said, I set out on this story just looking at the data, trying to explain how we could have seen such a sharp drop off after the monthly enrollment had skyrocketed from 200,000 to almost 300,000 in the span of about a year and a half or two. And then I, you know, started talking to people, and this is what came out, is that everyone I went to said it's probably the FSET. It's probably the requirements. And, you know, it seems that this is having at least some effect. Like I said, Milwaukee has unemployment that is still higher than the state across the board. Unemployment among African Americans is still much higher across the state. That's 11%. And some of our numbers around how the economy is performing don't hold up based off some recent reports. So, you know, the governor likes to point to the unemployment rate as the indicator of where our economy is at in this state. But, you know, that is certainly not an all-encompassing measure. And, you know, not everybody is employed. And clearly there are still people that need help. Many of the people who I talk to would like to see the state invest more in terms of raising the minimum wage, in terms of making some proactive – taking some proactive steps that directly benefit workers and people in order to help them get back on their feet.
All right. Well, Jabril, Derek, thank you so much for joining me here in studio.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Jabril Farage is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Derek Osborne is a student at MATC, a disabled veteran, and a former food share recipient. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And you can read the full story on Wisconsin's food share program by going to WUWM.com.
Next on the show, a new book tries to open a window into some of the lesser-known wings of the Trump administration. We'll speak with the author when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. As you're no doubt aware, President Trump made enormous waves over the weekend with his latest series of tweets, this one involving professional athletes and the national anthem. Hardly a week goes by when 140-character messages by the president don't dominate the headlines.
But a new book by Wisconsin writer John Nichols makes the case that for every presidential tweet story, there is an equally important one involving other members of President Trump's administration. The book is called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, and Nichols, who is the national affairs writer for The Nation, joins us on the line from Madison. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure.
How would you want or maybe expect people to use this book?
I think people should use it in a number of ways. First off, I hope it's a good read. I mean, when you write a book, that's what you want. So it's got a lot of history as well as a lot of observation of the current moment. But beyond that, I think this book is called A Field Guide for a reason. It provides entries into a lot of areas of government that don't get much attention from major media, and that especially don't get much attention now, as Donald Trump seems to suck all the air out of the room. Every time he tweets, we pay attention to that. And it's not inappropriate to pay attention to Trump. But what I argue with this book is that beyond Donald Trump, beyond what he does on any given day, are all the people that he has given positions of immense power, both in running cabinet departments, but also in running regulatory agencies. And on a daily basis, no matter what Trump is doing, these people are actually actually implementing an agenda, a very aggressive agenda, that is transforming America.
Right. I gather that there is some real significance to the fact that, with just a few exceptions, practically no one in this book is an elected official. What are we talking about in terms of the state of the executive branch?
Well, that's a very good question. One of the things that I recognized as I was writing this book is that Donald Trump is really sort of an early warning alarm about the vulnerabilities, maybe a late warning alarm about the vulnerabilities in the American political system. So his election certainly was an alarm as regards the Electoral College. People can choose where they want to go on that issue, but it told us the Electoral College can in fact make someone who has lost by a wide margin president of the United States. Similarly, once Trump came into power, as he went through his transition process, you saw him bring people into positions of immense authority. Really folks with the power to define whole sectors of the American economy, as well as our health care, our education, our environment, issues of war and peace. He brought folks in who were very much on the fringe, even of his own political party. And what you realize is that a president now who has a Congress that is aligned with him, at least a Senate that is aligned with him, really has the ability through appointments to fundamentally transform not just government, but how the United States functions. And we're seeing that play out. And really what I sought to do with the book was to point to how cabinet government and the regulatory state actually is very vulnerable to extreme political swings. And also, as an extension of that, that we are vulnerable.
How did you deal with the issue of the moving target, if you will? Knowing that as you're writing this book, some of the people in it would either be gone from the Trump administration or have more or less influence in the Trump administration.
Absolutely. One of the things I started out by doing was basically making a commitment that I would look at all the people that Donald Trump chose to empower as he came to the presidency. Because it's a very, very good signal about who he wants in what place and also who has influence in the broad sense, in the policy sense. This isn't just about personalities. This is about initiatives. It's about an approach to the environment, an approach to education, an approach to budget issues, whether you fund domestic programs or the Pentagon. And so I used many of these people that I look at as vehicles to look more deeply at the policy implications. So if someone, say a Sebastian Gorka, who is in the White House, gets bumped out or moves out of the White House, it doesn't really matter so much. The fact is that Donald Trump put this person there initially and, in fact, deferred to Gorka clearly on a number of issues. Now, the reality is that about 95% of the people I write about are in exactly the position that they were in, at the start. There isn't really as much churn in the administration as people think. There have been some high-profile exits, like people like Steve Bannon. And one of the arguments I make as regards Bannon, I make it in the book and certainly have it in discussing it, is that Bannon always accepted the title of chief strategist. He's interested in the campaign, in the White House, and now as he's left the White House, in the strategies that surround Donald Trump to initiate number of political projects. And I would suggest that understanding these people, understanding someone like Bannon, is important whether he is at the moment in the White House or on the edge of the White House seeking with many of the same funders, with many of the same allies, to advance the same agenda. So the moving target thing didn't bother me too much.
Right, and I was going to ask about Steve Bannon. You would make the case that even out of the White House, even without the title of chief strategist, without any official ties to Donald Trump at this stage, he holds a certain amount of sway within the Trump sphere of influence.
My argument would be he is more powerful because of his close ties to Robert and Rebecca Mercer and other funders of very right-wing political projects. As he's left the White House, he's repositioned where he was before he came into the White House, and that is as a central figure on the very far right wing, some say alt-right. I would say really just on the far right wing of what we refer to as conservatism. It's actually a kind of a restructuring of conservatism. But the bottom line is, as Bannon says correctly, he, on the outside, has a unique ability to influence the administration by propping up Donald Trump, as he said he will do, but also by going after Donald Trump's critics and opponents, both in the Democratic Party but also in the Republican Party. So I think Bannon's influence is immense. And I would also note that when Donald Trump spoke at the UN the other day, the speech that he gave was written at least in part by Stephen Miller, who is still in the White House, very close associate of Bannon's, very close associate of Jeff Sessions, somebody who comes out of this same ideological circle. And so the influence doesn't shift just because, you know, you have one player on the board moved. It's quite obvious that the Bannon ideology, if you will, via Stephen Miller, is still very influential in the White House.
So putting aside Steve Bannon or Jeff Sessions or any of these other really high-profile people, who are some of the lesser-known officials you think we ought to be aware of?
Yeah, I think that Stephen Miller is a very good person to pay attention to. He's very young, 32 years old, really grew up on the far right, and brings all of the extremes, all of the ideas that Bannon has professed and that Bannon's been noted for, deep into the White House as somebody who's writing president's speeches, helped to write the inaugural speech, helped to write the UN speech, very active in the Muslim ban. He's a classic example. But there are other folks that we don't pay as much attention to. I always point to Elaine Chao. She is the wife of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. She's a veteran of Republican administrations and in many senses a classic Washington insider. And yet, as I write in the book, wherever she has gone, she has been very, very involved in restructuring the agency she heads to make it dramatically more corporate, dramatically more supportive of privatization. She has a very, very aggressive agenda. And why that agenda becomes incredibly important at this point is because the Department of Transportation that she heads is very likely to have a lot of influence as regards infrastructure. And if it is indeed a trillion-dollar infrastructure program, you have a person in charge of one of the key agencies who really doesn't even have an interest in the old FDR-type Civilian Conservation Corps, WPA infrastructure. This is something much more privatized, much more corporate, and frankly, much more costly. And so you need to know about her. Another example, Scott Pruitt over at the EPA. Many people are aware of him, but I'm not sure everyone's aware of how militantly critical he is of climate science and how he has used his position to undermine the work of scientists who warn us that we really are faced with an environmental catastrophe. And the final person I point to, although there's many, many,
sure,
is Mick Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget. Mulvaney was in the House of Representatives. He was so far to the fringe that he was really thought of as sort of the top advocate for shutting down the federal government. Now, he oversees budget issues. Why that is significant is that his budget proposals, which are very influential, and actually some of which have even started to get some traction in Congress, his budget proposals invariably default to an idea of downsizing domestic programs in radical ways. He even attacks Meals on Wheels programs as, you know, too costly or inefficient, and moving that money in the tens of billions, even the hundreds of billions, over to the Pentagon. And what I argue in the book is that this really is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about when, in his last speech as president, he spoke of a military-industrial complex, a situation where the military becomes so dominant that and this isn't to dislike the military, it's just to say the imbalance becomes so extreme that domestic programs suffer, and that, frankly, democracy itself is undermined by a loss of the ability via budgeting to define our domestic future.
I wanted to ask you about one other name that that jumps out a little bit in terms of how he fits into the current Trumposphere. You count Paul Ryan among the so-called horsemen, and here's a guy who at some levels seems to have been at odds with the president, certainly from time to time. Where do you see him fitting in?
That's a very good question. Look, Paul Ryan is a man of government. He's been in Washington for, you know, the better part of more than a quarter century as an aide and now a member of Congress. He's clearly someone who would like to be the mainstream of the Republican Party and has been so as its former vice presidential candidate. But what I point out with Ryan is that ever since Trump arrived on the scene, he has had an enabling relationship with Trump, despite the fact that much is made of his occasional disagreements with the president. What Ryan always does, going back to 2015, is grumble a little about what the president says, raise an objection, but then at the end of the grumbling, say, well, of course, if he's the Republican nominee, I'll back him. Just as he now says, well, of course, I will work with him. And, you know, instead of standing up to Trump and really restoring that system of checks and balances, I would argue that Paul Ryan has been very much an enabler of Donald Trump. And the tragedy of that is that Paul Ryan does know at least something about the legislative process. Donald Trump does not. And one of the reasons why we have so much dysfunction in Washington at this point is because Paul Ryan has deferred to Donald Trump on so many issues, on too many issues, rather than leading.
One of the curiosities of this presidency is the kind of open question of who really has the president's ear. And on one level, you can describe these people as having their hands on the levers of power. But how much do we really know about whose hands are the heaviest at this point?
Well, that's a very good question. But there's an answer to it that may surprise folks. It's quite clear that going in, Donald Trump knew very, very little about cabinet government and very, very little about the regulatory agencies. I doubt he could have named them all, and frankly, I doubt most Americans could. But he really wasn't prepared to oversee these agencies, to oversee the people that he appointed. And in many cases, they are moving on their agendas, whether they talk to Trump on a daily basis or not. You look at Scott Pruitt at the EPA, his restructuring the EPA is moving at an incredibly fast rate and really putting it at odds with many of the environmental agendas and ideals that were core to its founding. Similarly, over at Justice, it is true that Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions, once very close, now grumble at each other and don't always get along. But Jeff Sessions is rolling straight forward over at the Department of Justice, radically changing the policies of the United States on civil rights, voting rights, and a host of other issues. So one thing to understand is once these people are empowered, because Trump himself is not a detail man and does not have, by most measures, a long attention span, these people are moving on the basis of the power they've been given. Now, within the inner circle of the White House, I think that it is a constantly revolving reality. But one thing I'll remind people of, when Donald Trump goes to give a major speech, it's very often that Stephen Miller, it's very often that Trump defers to him. The other person who I think is quite influential still is Gary Cohen over on the economic side. I do think that Trump listens to him quite a bit, and Cohen is extending that sort of Goldman Sachs economics in the White House. But, you know, as I write about all these people, one of the things that becomes very, very clear is that on any given day, if you're in that West Wing, your stature may rise or fall, but it's never constant. Many people thought that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner would be guiding a lot of things at the White House. It's now quite clear that on issue after issue, their counsel may be taken, but it's not followed.
John Nichols, it's really interesting reading. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
Wisconsin writer John Nichols is a writer for The Nation magazine, and he's the author of the new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. He'll talk about it Wednesday night at Boswell Book Company.
One more break, and then we catch up with Theater Gigante and its newest production, I Am My Own Wife. Lake Effect returns right after this on WUWM. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are many stories of bravery and survival from the Second World War, from soldiers risking everything to save their comrades to everyday people helping others escape. But one story of survival is perhaps not as well known, and that may be because Charlotte von Mahlsdorf hid herself in plain sight during the Nazi regime.
Born Lothar Berfelde in 1928, von Mahlsdorf was a self-described transvestite. She survived both the war and life in East Germany as openly transgender and was a beacon of hope to other European LGBTQ people throughout her life. That life inspired the one-person play I Am My Own Wife in 2004, which won the Pulitzer, the Tony, and the Drama Desk Awards for Best Play.
Theater Gigante opens I Am My Own Wife this Thursday. It stars Michael Stebbins, who plays a total of 35 characters. It's directed by Theater Gigante founder Isabel Krall, who explains that in real life, like in the play, Charlotte was complex.
In the end, there's a lot of things that are brought into the play where you begin to understand why she did what she did, and you also understand that maybe she didn't create quite so much harm to people, except, of course, maybe to her dear friend. But it's very interesting. The play is very much open to you thinking about it and making your own opinions and understanding her and what she did to survive.
Yeah, and I mean, we can sit here and say, oh, well, I wouldn't have done that, but you didn't necessarily live through what she lived through.
Yeah.
And you don't know what you would do faced with that. I mean, she killed her own father to survive.
Yes, if she did. You know, we talk about that. Did she really do these things?
As a reporter asks her later, you know, where is the copy of the death certificate? Where is the court, you know, record? She weaves such interesting and intricate stories that she's a great storyteller, I think. But yes, at the end, I think one may wonder, was she really doing all this in a skirt and a pair of heels, running around, standing in front of SS men and infantry police in her long blonde hair? It's convincing. I'm convinced when I say it, I have to be. And as an audience member, I don't doubt her. But question marks do arise, I think, throughout.
And that brings us to this play and the fact that not only are you playing her, you're playing Charlotte, you're playing about 40 other people, too.
Right.
35, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Including the playwright.
Yeah,
Doug Wright. I mean,
Wright.
He's a character in his own play, which is so it's not only I am my own wife, but I am my own character in my own play, which is which I always find funny, too. But it's such a powerful piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing piece, an amazing opportunity. And to be sharing the text and her life now, it feels like in this world right now, a lot of what she speaks of is right on the surface of just the tension in the world, I think. So saying some things, though they're 19 this or 19 that, feels very current. And a lot of things, I think, have always existed then.
Do you think she would have been surprised by the relative openness of LGBTQ life now, the fact that it is so much more in the public discourse than it was?
I don't know if she would have been surprised. I don't know, Michael, what you think about her character, but I find that there's almost an otherworldliness about her. There's this wisdom about her and this calmness. And I fall in love with her right at the beginning of the play already. And I don't think she would be surprised by anything. That's my feelings towards her, that she had this wisdom of knowing who she is and how the world maybe reacts to her, and it doesn't matter because I can take care of things. You know, there's almost imagination she had that helped her cope with everything. And so I think she would be amused at how advanced she herself always was.
Right. It's just thought of the phrase, you know, she's very matter of fact, and that has to do with there's never a question really in the play or big scene maybe in the discovery of putting on a dress for the first time, but once that happens, there's very little attention called to anything that she is.
Mm-hmm.
She just appears as she appears.
That's the beauty, I think, of the play, or
right.
at least, you know, part of it. I mean, there's
just
so
that
much
acceptance of it.
Yeah.
Right.
That the whole thing, and that's one reason why Gigante gravitated toward it. It's not a black and white issue. I mean, all the issues, all the themes in the play, you make up your own mind. It's just, here are the facts, here are the facts, here are the facts. And the beauty of it is that she is in a dress the whole play, and you don't question it. You accept it, which is, I think, the strongest, most powerful message to give, you know, where whoever's in the audience is accepting it. There's the best message for the LGBTQ community and support for it, I think.
Michael, for you, in the all of the different roles that you have to assume, do you stay in that one costume? How does the actual acting part of it work for you?
You know, I think the black dress, the black head wrap, I'm basically in black except for pearls. It's a, I think, very ingenious outfit because you're left with a lot of the face and hands. I mean, it's just very, really focuses things down. So in terms of a one-actor piece, I think it's sort of ingenious. I don't know, you know, if you've seen many one-actor pieces where, you know, it's always about props and costumes and this and that. This lets go of all of that. In a way, I think it's very brave that it does that because we're left with the word.
Well, and it also puts a little pressure on the actor to not depend on those props and those costume changes and all of that.
Right.
You really have to know who those people are.
Yes, yes. A number of the Nazi gentlemen, you know, you're thinking of, who is this? Who is this? Who is this? And at the beginning, I thought, I don't want them all to sound like Colonel Klink. I hope not everyone's going to go, oh, Hogan's Heroes. But as an actor, it's hard to just put on a voice in this play. Even if they appear for 30 seconds, they have to be fully realized. One of the things that I think was interesting, we did a run the other day, and I was feeling very free, you know, the actor exploring the role. And when it was over, Isabel and I were talking about how did that feel. I said it felt very free. But the thing that's interesting is there's so much description in these stories that almost less is more approach. You paint, you're the storyteller, and the audience is really allowed to let these images flow over them. And I think it's very moving in that regard.
Yeah, and having the freedom to just let that happen. And again, as you were saying about the bravery of the way it's constructed, mm-hmm. the way the piece is constructed, it's also, you know, to allow the audience to help you create that.
Right.
Letting it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the hardest things to do, I think.
Well, it's a thing that I think should often happen, you know, an artist giving over control to the words.
Mm-hmm.
And when that doesn't happen, you know, sometimes it doesn't necessarily work. And that's what I think is so great about this piece. It's also very fragmented. And so the scenes have to be played so that in a very brief time, they're believable. You fall into the scene and you're quickly out of that scene. And so therein also lies the need to be completely honest with the scene and to not be trying to put any kind of pretense onto the characters, you know, to just play it completely straight the way it is.
So, Michael, tell me about this little piece that you're going to give us, this little taste of the script.
It's the end of the first act, and it sort of sums up or brings us to a point of what we've just witnessed in the first act and how her safety and her security, she's always brought back to, I think, the world of music that helped her along the way.
Even when I was a little child, no one wanted phonographs. Everyone said to me, it's so old-fashioned. They all wanted radios. But what did I want with a radio? To hear Hitler babble? No, thank you. That is the reason that even today I don't have a radio or a television. For me, gramophones, polyphones, pianolas, I must truly say, these machines gave me so much pleasure in my childhood. If I hadn't had them, I'm not sure I would have survived. Things were so ghastly with my father. Everything my mother and I went through. But the music would pour through the horn and make things better.
Beautiful writing and lovely performance.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for doing that on the spot.
Yeah.
That's terrific. I'm so looking forward to hearing all of it.
Oh, good.
And Isabel, this is also not just that this is a special show, but this is your 30th anniversary as a company.
It is.
So congratulations, first of all, on
that. Thank you very much.
For making it in the long distance there.
Thanks.
I mean,
yeah.
That's not easy.
We were very excited and, just had our fingers crossed that we would reach this landmark. So, yes.
So looking back at the 30 years and then looking forward to things to come, I mean, what have you learned about making theater over that time? And has it changed?
Well, it's funny. I've always had a really wide array of interests in theater. And whenever I created things 30 years ago, it had movement in it, but it was always theater. It was always theatrical. And I really started the company out of this odd desire to be able to bring to the audience whatever I thought was really good and whatever I was really excited about. And so the company has always had this hybrid reputation that sometimes has even been hard for critics. I don't think that's the case anymore, but in the past, for critics to really be able to define us. So in that sense, what I've learned is from each individual project. I think each individual project teaches me more and more and more about theater, about what's so wonderful about it, and about the craft itself. I've directed most of the productions, including this one, and I always feel I'm learning more and more how to bring moments, you know, to life and things like that. What's been a wonderful challenge is this hybridness when we do have movement or video or music, is how to cross over the scenes so that things flow seamlessly rather than like a musical, you know, where all of a sudden a song pops in. So all of this has brought me great joy, and all the actors and movers and dancers and musicians we've had the opportunity to work with. Mark Anderson and I are now co-directors of this. Mark joined the company in 99, and we write most of our stuff. This play has not been written by us, of course. It's by Doug Wright, but I think both of us have found a real joy in being able to work this way in this hybrid sense, because Mark also has many, many interests.
Well, it just makes the end product for the audience richer, I think. When you're, again, you have that freedom to bring in everything, all of you, to whatever you're doing.
That's what I think, because
yeah.
I think the dance and music and all that is expressionistic, and so you do get to bring in, and it can also become more conceptual. I'm less interested in naturalistic plays, and so the ability to play with theater concept and to make things work and to find that a scene, like there's many scenes in this production, I Am My Own Wife, that are fragmented and short and minimalist, and they are so moving, you know, to find that you can do that without having to try to mirror naturalistic life on stage.
Yes. And Michael, you're the beneficiary of the 30 years of exploration and freedom, because you're getting to do this great piece.
Yeah. When I first moved to this area back in 2014, Isabel and Mark sort of opened their door to me and said, come on over, let's chat, because I wrote some theaters and said, I'm coming to town. And from that moment on, working with them, hanging out with them, has been so interesting. And this piece, I admire Isabel and Mark very much. But the hybrid theater, you know, for someone who came from a training program, get in a room the first time to work on my Dear Othello and be doing this kabuki stuff. And I'm like, why am I saying this line over and over? And why am I killing you four times? And why am I strangling you but not touching you? And then the frustration the first time, but then the sort of eye-opening experience and the rules or no rules. And then this piece is quite wonderful because how do you have four people in a scene at the same time? And how do you do that? And Isabel is just sort of, I think, a miracle worker in terms of all the skill sets that she actually has, you know, and can see something and say something that you'd never think of. People see Gigante pieces and you find yourself talking about them long after you've seen them. There's a lot to digest.
It has been such a pleasure having you both in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so
much for having us.
Congratulations on the 30 years. Here's to another however many years you feel that you have the energy to do it.
Thank you very much.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Michael Stebbins stars in Theater Gigante's production of I Am My Own Wife, and company founder Isabel Krall directs. It opens at the Kenilworth 508 Theater on the East Side this Thursday and runs through October 7th. There is more information at WUWM.com. That is all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Right now it's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.